Welcome to another all-new episode of the 3-Bid League podcast. As always, I'm Tyler, joined by my co-host, Matt. And today, we're going to go for a little bit of a quicker episode. We're going to dive into just a few little things from last week's opening games, and then we're going to jump into the mailbag. And as always, a big thank you to everyone who sent in a mailbag question. We got plenty of good ones again this episode. It's been a very, very long time since we have had to scramble on a mailbag episode. Everyone continues to just come through in big ways with these for us.
Yeah, thanks again. As always, we got a bunch of great mailbag questions. And it's just like in college basketball, you need a good performance from the bench. And sometimes the starters can't do it all themselves. So thank you all for giving us some topics to work with tonight. And it should be a fun episode as we recap a little bit of what happened in the first week of conference play and talk about what to expect moving forward.
Yeah, and the Golis Standard did name us to the unofficial A10 Twitter starting five, so that analogy actually does work.
All right, that's good to know. I wonder if we're taking up two spots in the starting lineup or if it's like a joint. I mean, it's one Twitter account.
I think we're splitting it, yeah.
That's fine with me. But yeah, thank you to those guys too.
Yeah. They got a good question coming up for us later, but we'll start with last week. And right now, the Dayton Flyers sit alone atop the A-10 at 2-0. Five other teams at 1-0. Davidson and Duquesne both picked up a win and lost to those Flyers. And, I mean, the biggest topic of the week has to be Dayton. And I want to just start it off with a very simple statement. Holmes and Kamara, as a duo, are just wrecking everyone in their path right now. And I basically see no reason why that's going to stop at any point in the next 2 months.
Yeah, especially Daron Holmes. And I just want to point out in the
Kamara's
two games... Kamara's
guarding Foster Lawyer, for God's sake.
Well, he was amazing, but... In the two games since I proclaimed that Holmes was not Dayton's best player, he's scored 54 points. Just a remarkable run for him. And I actually checked. So he's had five consecutive 20-point games, which matches the career high of Obi Toppin, who accomplished that in the first five games of his sophomore season. So what Holmes is doing is truly impressive right now. He's finally taking charge on the offensive end, where earlier in the season he wasn't having as big of an impact as Dayton fans were hoping for. But against Davidson, that was one of the most impressive offensive showcases I think we've seen all year.
Ridiculous. That's the only way to describe it. Or I guess dominant would probably be the best term, but he was even making his jumpers. He hit a three. He hit a turnaround. He finished above 60% from the line. Like, he was just excellent in every facet of the game. And I don't know. Like, I'm trying to hold back on declaring this just the beginning of a run of utter dominance for the Flyers, but it's kind of starting to feel that way. There's no one who can match up with these two guys on both ends. There are great big men in this league who can go toe-to-toe with one of them, but there's absolutely no one who's equipped to battle them both.
No, I don't think there is, but I'm not ready to say Dayton's going to dominate anybody, or at least the whole conference, just because we saw another recurring problem where in the second half against Davidson, the Flyers went about 11 or 12 minutes without making a field goal, and they're still having some slow stretches throughout the game. Their guard play just isn't up to standard of an A-10 champion right now. And maybe it will get there if Sharv Jumps gets back on track where he was earlier in the season. Kobe Bray has been in and out of the lineup, having some good games recently. But overall, those cold spells are still just giving Dayton some trouble. And fortunately, Holmes was able to put the team on his back enough for Dayton to come away with a pretty easy road win, but that still gives me some concern for Dayton that they just struggled for a big stretch of the game.
So I wanted to talk about this, and we'll mention a question because we ended up getting a mailbag snippet that basically the question fits the answer that I was about to give. It's kind of a Jeopardy style thing. And it's a two-parter, so we'll come back to it later. But the screener pod asked, will Dayton be salvageable minus Malachi Smith? And I said last week that if they could get Malachi for at least about 12 games of the conference season, basically two-thirds, that they would win the conference. And they probably needed him for that. After these two games, I'm not sure that's true. I think they can still win this conference without him, partially because, as we talked about last week, you might only need like 13 wins to do it. But for them to kind of mimic the champions of the past, the dominant 15 and 3, 16 and 2 squads that we see, and to be a team that, by the way, if they do that, still has a chance to get an at-large bid, then they need Malachi. So it's there's almost two layers to this. The way that they're playing right now, and how great the two big guys are playing, and how well Kobe Brea is playing at this point, he's back to the exact guy who won Sixth Man of the Year last year, if not better, honestly. And with how well Amzil's shooting the ball, like, they might just flat out be the best team in this conference without Malachi and Kobe Elvis. And against weak teams, they're going to destroy them. There's just not teams that are set up to match up with these guys. But the problem becomes when we get deeper into the year, they don't have another way to play. And when we start getting to March, where they have to go to Chaffetz, they got to play the A10 tournament. They could potentially have an NCAA tournament game. They have to have Malachi at that point because the only guy right now who can truly create off the dribble on this team is Kobe Brea. At least the way Sharv Jompson is playing right now, he honestly looks like he hasn't had his confidence since the UNLV game. And unless he gets back to that level, they don't have a secondary layer to this offense. They don't have anything that they can turn to when a defense denies Daron Holmes the ball. Like, that's kind of just where they're at. They don't have another layer to elevate themselves.
Well, and that's even what Davidson was doing during that cold stretch. Monango is kind of struggling with foul trouble, so they brought in Sean Logan, who barely plays for them, and he ended up doing a great job defending Holmes. But yeah, I mean, I think these two games show that Dayton can easily still contend in the A10 without Malachi Smith. I just think that's more of an indictment on the A10, though, than anything, because it's still
Yeah, you're
a
not,
little
you're
bit of a.
certainly not wrong.
I mean, it's not hard to contend in the A10 this year compared to years past. So I just think that limits the ceiling, though, where like the best case for Dayton, if they never get Malachi back, is they run through the A10, get a 12 seed, and lose by double digits against a power conference team.
Look, if they don't have Malachi, they can win this conference and waltz right into that NIT auto bid. They can't put together enough wins to get an at-large, and I don't think they can win three games in 4 days. But
Yeah.
if they get him back, then all of those things really come into play. And honestly, if he's the guy that he was in the second half of last season, I think it wouldn't be unreasonable for Dayton fans to begin to expect that this team should make the tournament.
Well,
At the level that they would be over everyone else in this conference right now, save for St. Louis, but that's a St. Louis team that they match up extremely well against.
yeah, it could be. And I think overall, Dayton looks great. I mean, that Davidson game, too, like going down the schedule, that's probably one of the four or five most difficult games they have the rest of the season. And the fact that they ended up winning by 14, I think that should give you confidence.
Did their lead ever get lower than six? Like,
Oh,
as bad as.
Davidson tied the game. It
Oh.
got bad. Yeah.
I missed a brief part of the early second half when Duquesne was wrapping up. But yeah,
Yeah.
every time I clicked over, Dayton was up by at least six.
No, I want to make sure. Yeah, it is clear that Dayton did not easily cruise in the second half. It was a dogfight for a good chunk of the game, but down the last 5, 6 minutes, they played pretty much perfect basketball to make it look better than it was. But speaking of Duquesne, I know you had a few thoughts on their performance last weekend, splitting against Dayton and Rhode Island.
Yeah, I mean, look, that Dayton game was ugly as hell. But that game was far more of a credit to how good Dayton's defense is than an indictment on Duquesne. I mean, I think we're going to look back in February and see Dayton firmly entrenched at the top of this conference and look at that game and just realize that Duquesne was a mid-conference team who just hung around with a team that's just simply better than them. If you look at Duquesne's schedule, that's their second toughest game of the entire season behind going on the road to Kentucky. Now, they came out on Saturday at home against a most likely pillow fight Rhode Island team and did everything in the world to justify that they were not a good team. That was one of the worst halves that they've played the entire season, but they're at home. They are better than Rhode Island. And if they were truly a team that has a chance to finish in the top four, they had to come out and just drop the hammer on them early in the second half. And that's what they did. And really, just kind of a few scattered thoughts from that game that I had. Number one, Day-Day Grant is actually too unselfish. He refused to take tough shots in that first half. And it's wonderful that he wants to be a great distributor like that, but their offense was just bad in the first 20 minutes. And the biggest thing that sparked them is he started trying to take over in the second half. He was taking tough contested shots and he was making most of them. But Duquesne needs him to be a little bit more of an alpha. He seems to be an alpha from a mentality standpoint for the team, but he has to do it too with the ball. And then on the Rhode Island side, I was impressed by their forwards in that game. Like they hung around the whole time with Duquesne, despite the fact that Freeman and Leggett both got shut down. And if you had told me going in that that was going to happen, I would have assumed that Duquesne won by 30 to 40 points. Brandon Weston is, he's going to be something. I don't know if he's a star in this league, but he is definitely a very, very useful four-year player. And I came out of that game just wondering if Rhode Island might be a little bit closer to escaping the pillow fight than the basement. Like their role guy, that was probably the best that their role guys played the entire season. And that was despite the fact Malik Martin was non-existent in that game too. So they did it without their kind of three best perimeter guys making much of an impact.
Yeah, I mean, that'll be the key. And I feel like throughout this season, we've seen Rhode Island have good halves. Like, the Boston College game, I think they were ahead at halftime. Georgia State on the road, they were playing well for about the first 25, 30 minutes of that game. And then against Duquesne in the first half, they were the better team. But it's just been inconsistency, kind of similar to Dayton, where they just go through dry spells where they can't score. But that is going to be key, because I think we've seen with the Rams, an offense that's just being carried by Leggett and Freeman isn't going to be good enough. So they're going to need some of the role guys like Brandon Weston, like Alex Chikwu, who played 15 minutes. Rory Stewart came off the bench and played more than normal. So maybe some of these other guys can step up. But yeah, overall, just ended up looking kind of bad in the final scores. Duquesne ran away in the second half.
Well, and I'm glad you went through those names because we've now finally hit that beautiful point in the season where we get to start seeing more of these teams in person. I had only caught Duquesne and Dayton in the non-conference, and things should be lined up pretty well here for me to see at least two-thirds of the other teams before we get to Brooklyn. But Rory Stewart looked really good in that game, and that shot looks kind of clunky on TV. Seeing it actually with my own two eyes, it's extremely smooth for what is he, 6'11? I don't think he's quite 7 foot, but he's confident taking it. He's got a good motion and things looked good. Like that's a potential game-swinging weapon for Rhode Island. I think one of their bigger wins of the year, we're going to see a big Rory Stewart scoring game off the bench. And then just the one other like in-person observation, Because I've been down on Media Row for these Duquesne games most of the year. I was actually up in the upper deck on Saturday. And down at the bottom, you get to see kind of the defensive power that David Dixon plays with. Like he is vicious as a shot blocker. You don't see it down low, but you catch it from up top. He runs like elegantly. He's 6'10". He moves like a gazelle. I saw him close out on a three. Like it's just two steps and just sliding right past the guy with his hand up. I mean, he barely plays for this team now that everybody's healthy. My God, if he stays there, he's a tremendous asset for Duquesne in the next few years. Although, if I guess Rotrov's gone next year and Reese and Williams could be as well. But if Duquesne wasn't losing any big men, that's the kind of guy who actually should be on his way out. Because he's the best guy to get marooned on Duquesne's third unit, like maybe ever in the history of the program. Certainly in the last 15 years, he is the most talented guy to not be in the rotation. It speaks to the depth of this team.
Well, there you go. Some deep freshman insights. Any other general thoughts? We had seven games on Saturday, so a lot of action around the conference, but any other general thoughts before we get into the mailbag for this week?
Well, I want to talk about James Bishop, but he comes up in the mailbag, so I'll
Oh,
save it
we'll
for
have some
that.
James Bishop in this
And
one.
Lyle, basically all the things I wanted to cover briefly show up in the mailbag. James Bishop, Daryl Banks, Loyola, I say with a huge sigh that I hope you can hear over the microphone.
Oh, we can.
A game that I just kind of missed because the A10 screwed us and put six games at once on Saturday. I caught little glimpses of it, but holy hell, like George Mason's defense is pretty good. And KenPom said it all year, but I didn't fully buy it. And I think we're just going to be beating our head against the wall with this team all year. Because if their best guys were playing the same level offensively as they did last year, they're a top four team in this conference, probably without a doubt. Because this defense is awesome this season. But once again, they couldn't score. Like Ronald Polite just completely saved them on that end. He's the only guy that's better offensively this year than he was last year. Everyone else is worse, so.
Yeah, I don't really know what to make of that George Mason game. Like, it's great to see Ronald Polite playing so well and so much better than last year, but also with the rest of their lineup combining for 40 points. I mean, that's on most nights, that's not going to be enough to win. They just shut down Richmond.
It kind of goes back to my biggest concern with Richmond. They just don't have enough playmakers, and you go back to the box score, and this was really clear in the closing minutes. Like they just couldn't do anything that wasn't Burton related.
Matt Grace,
Like,
15 points. He's had
yeah,
some big games
I mean,
recently.
their offense was pretty bad despite the fact that Burton was just kicking ass up and down that court all game.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. That ended up being probably, I don't know if we'd say that's the biggest game of the weekend, but two true double bye contenders went down to the wire with George Mason winning it at home. I still don't
Dayton
think it.
Davidson was the biggest game of the weekend.
Oh, I'm also the one that had Davidson in 10th place, though, so gotta keep that in mind with my
I mean,
bias.
those are two top half teams, one of whom should be top two. So,
Well, we'll see. There's a long way to go.
but
But
there's a universe that Dayton Duquesne was the biggest game of the week, but that was not on the weekend.
no. How about Davidson Fordham? Just going back to that, how did Davidson? So I was at the Dayton game at the same time, but how did Davidson hold Fordham to 43? Like, I'm trying to picture. Did they just miss everything?
Well, so Davidson's perimeter defense,
It's bad.
that's the weird thing, is it?
Yeah.
Because it was the same thing they did in the Purdue game where they were just so good on the rotations and closing out on open shooters. Now, granted, Fordham missed too many open threes, but Davidson did a great job of contesting them. Like, all the metrics say their perimeter defense is awful, and the Northeastern game certainly backed that up. But in their two biggest games, two of their three biggest games of the year so far, they have shut down their opponent from three, and if you were watching those games, like what you were seeing for the most part matched the stats. Like Fordham, it shouldn't have taken Fordham 25 minutes to make a three, but they shouldn't have made more than like one or two before that.
I would think, and I will apologize too. So Davidson is, they've had some good defensive performances as of late. They're actually holding opponents just under 30% from three, which I did not expect at all. But still, I think for Fordham, when you consider that a couple weeks ago they dropped 90 points on the road at Tulane, that's just shocking that they had such a letdown. And normally you'd think when you hold Davidson under 60, you're going to have a good chance to win. So that raises a little bit of concern. The Rams did have the weekend off, so maybe they'll come out firing this week with a little more enthusiasm on the offensive end. But man, I was checking the score throughout the night and I couldn't believe how bad they were shooting.
I mean, saving grace for Fordham, they will not shoot that bad again this year. But one thing that's becoming concerning for them is this is now back-to-back games against Davidson. Ironically, their last two A-10 games this week and the 1-8 game in DC last year, where their offense was wildly and completely useless, except for Rostislav Novitski and Zach Riley, who both had great games in both of those games. So if they catch the Wildcats again this year, like I think they should probably just start those two guys. Is
Do they
Zach
need
probably
to?
Zach Riley's two best career games, honestly, given the strength of the opponent.
It could be. All right. Well, let's get into the mailbag because we had a couple questions on another game I wanted to get to. And so our guest from last week, Parlay Pyle, asked us for some thoughts on the UMass St. Bonaventure game and if UMass is overrated or if this means the Bonnies might be underrated. And grouping it into Minutemen Media just asked a simple question, UMass, which is fair because I think the Minutemen are a big question mark right now. So we'll start though, Bonnies with a huge win at the Riley Center. What's your biggest takeaway from this one?
I mean, UMass underrated by the standard that Parlay Pyle put on them last week as a fourth place finisher this season, probably. Rated, I had him sixth. I feel pretty good about that still at this point. Say, I think St. Bonaventure's kind of properly rated too. Like they're gonna play well at home. That place is gonna be rocking even if they suck this year. But the biggest thing, Darryl Banks is going to go off three times in conference play. Like, that's just the level of scorer he is. He's 9 for 17 from the field, 31 points. And when they're playing a team like UMass who doesn't have an offense built for a shootout, they're going to win that game. And this is the give and take with Darryl Banks. This is like Bishop last year. It's kind of a lesser version of Ryan Daly a few years back on those bad St. Joe's teams, because Daly's just a more complete player than Banks. But Darryl Banks is going to absolutely kill Bonaventure three times in conference play, and he's going to carry them three times. And that's just the experience with him. Because he's the best crazy heat check guy in this conference right now. But being a crazy heat check guy also comes with some awfulness to it too.
I think so. I think you're right on that. And I think overall, I agree with UMass not being built to win these high scoring games. And overall, their offense just continues to slide, even though Noah Fernandes did return, although he was dealing with foul trouble the whole game and didn't make a huge impact. But I'm not too worried. Like, I don't think UMass is going to give up 83 points very often. I think it will take an individual on the other team just going off for a career day, as Darryl Banks did. And really, the only other time UMass has had a similar bad defensive performance is when UMass Lowell, the true flagship, just destroyed them at on the road. So I don't think it's a terrible thing for UMass. Like, it doesn't change my opinion of them too much. I still have them in that probably 5 through 7 range where I did last week. I'm just worried though about the offense. I mean, it just has not looked good in weeks now. And you just wonder how many nights there's going to be like this where the opponent's going to have a good shooting day and how UMass can respond.
Yeah, well, and by the way, one of the biggest things, the shot distribution for this game, Gapare 2, Weeks 3, Cross 7, those numbers are all just too low. Those are the guys, along with Fernandes, who are going to carry you offensively. And RJ Louise did have a good game, but you see, it just wasn't enough. I mean, even Conte, who played well because he was getting to the line, but he still only had 5 field goal attempts.
Yeah, I also wonder how much of this too when I look at UMass. And so this was a game they didn't have Wildenz Levesque. So I do have to wonder, like,
And it
he's
looks
one of
like they
the
might not for a little while
Yeah,
here.
and he's dealing with, I believe, a knee injury, so it could be out for the next couple weeks at least. But I wonder, just because going by both the eye tests and their stats this year, Conte is pretty clearly the better offensive player, although Levesque is a much stronger post defender. I almost feel like with UMass's struggles on the offensive end, and especially like their interior scoring just hasn't been good this year, if maybe long term getting Conte some more minutes could be a benefit to them. But on the defensive end, it certainly didn't work out for the Minutemen. So, any other thoughts on this one, or should we move on to? Or I guess we can segue this into James Bishop because I know we want to talk about him.
Well,
So
I'll throw one more quick thing because we didn't mention him. We talked too much, a little too much about UMass. In addition to Banks, like Jan Farrell was just great again. And I'm really close to calling him the funnest freshman right now, which is really saying something because we have like a borderline alien in Sharif Jahmes. And like Gumby himself and Reed Bailey. Jason Nelson, the passing wizard, but Jan Farrell is just a role player du jour who conducts himself like a senior out on that court.
Yeah, he was huge, 22 points, and I mean, with that, might have taken a slight lead in the rookie of the year race. He's definitely one of the contenders at this point. And
I think he's a lock for a rookie team at this point if he just stays healthy.
yeah, and when Schmidt trusts you as a freshman, I mean, that means you're gonna play this, so he'll be important to watch the rest of the year. But continuing on with this game a little bit, so Tristan Freeman from Busting Brackets asked us which team that had a surprising opening win is more real. GW, who shocked Loyola Chicago on the road, or St. Bonaventure, who took down UMass.
I kind of just feel like they're about the same level.
Yeah.
GW has a little bit more talent and their ceiling's higher from game to game, but it's the same reasoning that I gave as to why I have Bonaventure at the top end of the pillow fight. They got Kyrell Luke, Mark Schmidt, Jan Farrell cleaning up things on the glass, and an awesome Riley Center crowd. And those four things will keep them in most games. And whether or not they win, a lot of them will come down to how well Darryl Banks and Chad Venning play. I don't know. I guess they're probably no, GW is more real just because GW is going to have a better chance to pick up huge wins.
Yeah, I almost feel like so St. Bonaventure is pretty much a pick'em, but I think the margin of victory is what makes it more impressive to me. And I'm also just still having the opinion I think Loyola just might stink. Like that was a really good offensive game for
Yeah,
GW, and they almost dropped 100 on the road, but I'm also just not impressed by Loyola.
I mean, that doesn't do anything to change my opinion of this. I just think it's more likely that GW has a season like last year where they just win like two or three games. It feels like they have no business winning. And all of a sudden, they narrowly dodge playing in the pillow fight, and we kind of don't understand how it happened.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I'm almost wondering if this is just a similar path where GW picks off bad teams. And I still feel like they played well in the first two games at Diamond Head, even though they lost
They
those.
did.
I mean, their
They should have
offense
won the
is,
first one.
It's just so much more enjoyable to watch, and especially James Bishop. So I think, should we just go ahead and talk about him? Because even though Daron Holmes dominated Davidson, I mean, Bishop had the best game of the week. He had 40 points for the
Yeah, I
second
mean,
time this
Daron
year.
Holmes had two almost as good games, so Daron should have won it, but James Bishop was incredible. And what was the question for him?
We have a couple James Bishop questions, so we can start out. JJ asked us over under 20 points for Bishop in conference. He's sitting at 21.9 for the entire season. And I mean, getting the first game off with 40, that gives you a nice head start for
It
the rest
helps
of
a
the year.
lot. I think it's over. I think that's a big reason why, but
I think so too. And GW also, they play
he's gonna keep
pretty.
shooting, by the way. Like,
Yeah, and they play pretty up tempo. You know, they're not going to take the ball out of his hands, even though he is a lot less selfish this year. And he's done a great job setting up his teammates. But at the end of the day, he's still going to get his every night. And at this point, I think he has to be the favorite to lead the conference in scoring, too.
well, and by the way, as we get deeper into the season and we get these bigger games, and Caputo has to lean more on his best guys, who the hell do you trust on this team besides Bishop, Adams, Edwards, Lindo, Dean? I like kind of half trust EJ Clark, but he's not even out there right now. Like the gap between five and six on this team is astronomical. I don't believe in any of their bench players in an important moment.
No, not really. So, yeah, I mean, I think Bishop, the important thing for him, which he's done a good job of, he just needs to not force too many shots. And especially, I think he's taken more shots from two this year, where GW's been one of the most efficient teams in the conference and in the country. So he just needs to stick to that game plan. And then also overall, too, it just helps so much where Adams is having a special season of his own, averaging 16 or 17 a game. And I feel like even though Joe Bamisil had a good game or a good season last year, he didn't seem to be quite as consistent of a scoring threat, where Adams is putting up nice numbers pretty much every game. So I think that's just taken a lot of pressure off Bishop, where they can both consistently put up a lot of points. But another question too on Bishop, from Mr. Stuntman Marvin. Can Bishop be a legit A-10 player of the year candidate? And I dove into this one a little bit. I just still don't think GW is going to be good enough. Like, best case, I think they end up around 7th or 8th place like they did last year. And history tells us you still have to be on a really good team to win this award.
I'll make it very simple. They're not good enough. Like you have to be top four. And he's dominant enough that he could win it on a fourth place team. I think Tyler Burton is as well. But just like watch Daron Holmes and Tomani Kamara right now and tell me that one of those two on a first or second place Dayton team could lose to James Bishop on even a best case, like seventh place GW team, or if Yuri Collins wins the conference,
Yeah, I mean,
all the
maybe
other
in a
best
year,
players in
like
this conference are on good teams right now.
maybe this is the year where it could happen, where there might just not be any great teams, but I don't think it's likely. And you have to go back to the 2008, 2009 season when a player from a team outside the top four won this. It was Ahmad Nivens of St. Joe's, and they finished in a tie for 5th place. So it just doesn't happen. It's almost always a team out of
Is
the top
that
two.
also the least memorable player of the year in the last 20 years?
It probably, I mean, I barely remember him, and I consider myself a big A-10 fan, so yeah, it's been a while. So as fun as Bishop is to watch this year, I don't think it's gonna happen. We had another GW question we'll throw in from Noah. Thoughts on Caputo's haircut? I mean, I think he rocks it, but I don't know if you have anything else to add here.
All power to him.
I mean, some guys make it work.
Look, the shiny bald head is about the best move you can go with if you don't have like a real great thick head of hair. Like it's basically a line where you see so many coaches with the thinning hair or like the half and half. But if you're not going to be Jay Wright, you might as well just go the other end.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. So,
And by the way, like it's basically the same cut as Frank Martin, but for whatever reason, like the Caputo bald just kind of looks a little cooler than the Frank Martin bald. I think it's just shinier.
I was still so shocked because Frank Martin was not always bald. Like, that's a new development, right? In the last 2 years or so.
Oh,
'Cause when they went to the
he
Final
tells the
Four.
story.
Oh, okay. I
I
might have
think
missed this.
it might have. Apologies to Curry Hicks Sage if it was on his pod. I think it was on the Goodman Doster pod. He tells the story that basically COVID took his hair and it
Oh.
never grew back.
Interesting. What about would it be more shocking if Chris Caputo showed up next year with a full head of hair, like what Shaka Smart did when he joined Marquette a couple years ago? Or who's the other one? Buzz Williams did the same thing. That would be impressive too.
The Buzz Williams one was bad though. Shaka made me wonder why he was bald the whole time. Because he had a nice heavy head of hair after he grew it out.
Yeah, you just never know. Just kept it a secret all those years.
Yeah.
One more GW question. I missed this one, but Ryan Paleo just wanted us to discuss the Charles Entertainment Smith Center's free throw defense. And right now, opponents are shooting under 64% from the line against the Colonials. I don't have the home away splits, but I mean, I think we've already hit the nail on the head throughout the year. They have a home court advantage now. And especially coming off a nice win to start conference play. Hopefully, we get some students showing up.
Yeah, it makes a difference. It's been a good crowd this year. And it actually makes me remember one thing I did pass over earlier. Saturday, if we're looking at it from a perspective of just home fans, so it doesn't count when 1,000 Dayton fans roll in or 700 insanely rowdy Bonaventure fans are there. That was the best Duquesne crowd in at least 5 years and probably longer. It was legitimately rowdy. It was more than 50% full, which in there is still an accomplishment. So hopefully that keeps going. And
Yeah.
that was with no students at all. I think there was literally like three students in the entire building.
Well, hey, that's three more than there's been at some Duquesne games in the
Two.
past, I'm sure.
Two. There's one guy that shows up every time. So shout out to him, the guy in the Chuck Cooper jersey.
Nice. We gotta find him on A10 Twitter. I mean, if he's that big of a diehard, he's gotta be a sicko following the whole A10. But I wanna get over to the other half of GW from the weekend, and that's the team they beat, Loyola. And so Braden Norris fan club just asked us, why has everything gone wrong for Loyola this year? And as disappointing as Dayton and St. Louis have been, man, Loyola has just been kind of a disaster. And really just the one big win over Clemson to their name. Other than that, they haven't done anything notable.
Well, on a micro level, Saturday, that was by far the worst perimeter defense they've played since Myrtle Beach. Like, I get Bishop and Adams are awesome this year, but holy hell, that was just awful. The last 12 minutes of the game, those two were just dribbling to every single spot that they wanted to. Getting to the foul line, just swinging the ball around every time. And it's just not been as good as the past years, but I think the biggest thing is this is a microcosm of this great egalitarian system they've had since the Moser days, where they basically don't have a star player carrying them. It's everyone pitching in. And you start to see how badly it can get away when all of a sudden your fourth man's not as good as it was. Your fifth, sixth, seventh guys aren't the same. Last year's Loyola team was good because everyone from two through nine was a really strong contributor. You think of like the shooters they had coming off the bench, and Ugwuok could play two awful games in a row and it didn't matter because you knew he'd make up for it down the road. But they don't even have a guy as good as Lucas Williamson was on this team, and they have no depth at this point. The bench is still just really not doing much of anything. Except Bryce Golden. Bryce Golden was awesome in that game.
Well, I just think overall, like when you talk about what's gone wrong for Loyola, as we discussed in the preseason, they lost to all Missouri Valley defensive players. And this is a team that for years, ever since they went to the Final Four, has hung their hat on playing great defense. Well, this year they're pretty much average nationally. And when they also have a below average offense, that's just not going to cut it. And I think this GW game is the perfect example where they got torched at home against a team that's not supposed to be that great. And overall, I think the depth is another correct point where early in the year, when you see all these transfers and freshmen, it's easy for fans to say, oh, well, look at all the options we have. But at the end of the day, it's pretty much just Norris who's consistent night in and night out. Alston's had some big games, but he hasn't always shown up. And it's they just lack the star power from when they had some great teams in the Missouri Valley.
And I think we'll see from GW a lot in conference play. Loyola was able to pound their weakness, which is their interior defense. And the fact that, especially if Linda or Dean's not out there, it becomes brutally rough. Alston and Bryce Golden hammered them down low. GW's strength is the guards offensively. Loyola's strength is supposed to be their perimeter defense, and GW won that battle handedly.
I'm going to be interested to see, and I think it's way too early in his career to make any sweeping judgments, but with Drew Valentine in his second season, we've seen it a lot before where a coach takes over a really good program, and the first year, or maybe it's the second year, they have great results with the previous coach's players. And then as soon as those guys start to leave, there's a little bit of a rebuild. And I'm just wondering what happens next year and moving forward for Loyola, where if he reloads this team and gets it back on track to playing nasty defense and being one of the best defensive rebounding teams in the country, because that's another thing that's fallen off quite a bit for the Ramblers this year. And overall, I think they were picked fourth this year, which was definitely way too high looking back. But still, I don't
It
think there's
was
an
way too
excuse.
high the moment it happened, but
But still, I don't think there's much of an excuse for them to have struggled this much. I mean, they've just played a lot of bad games this year where you look back and it's like, that's not at all what you would have expected going in.
yeah, and my last point on this, maybe the biggest issue, they're coming off possibly the two best recruiting classes in school history. And the four-star, high three-star guys that put them in that spot are just playing minimal minutes off the bench right now. It's the guys who kind of remind you of traditional scrappier Loyola players that are helping them. Like Ben Schwieger is a guy that I don't think we spoke his name one time in their team preview this year. Tom
Yeah,
Welch
he's.
is a veteran who's been glued to the bench for years and just finally had his big breakout. Those are the guys who are outplaying the St. Thomases and the Quinns and the Dawsons and Sheldon Edwards, who was great at Valpo last year. I don't know. Maybe Loyola has to have unheralded scrappy guys to be good.
Yes. I mean, Mark Schmitz made it work for years and he got a t-shirt out of it, so. We'll see. I mean, it might just be figuring out the rotations throughout the year. I mean, they've had guys in and out. Like Schweiger has all of a sudden, like, yeah, we didn't know who he was. He might be an all-rookie team guy by the end of it, but just a mess and a really disappointing start in conference play. But we can move on. We have some more all-conference discussion I'd like to get you. First one from the Gola Standard, who asked us who's a better shot at making an all-conference team from LaSalle, Khalil Brantley or Josh Nickleberry? And I think the answer after
Neither.
going through the stats, it's got to be Brantley. He's almost averaging a triple nickel on the season, about one assist away, and he is quietly accumulating some stats this year. I just think we haven't talked about him that much since there hasn't been a ton to talk about with
Yeah.
LaSalle recently.
It's Brantley because of the scoring and the assists. He's just, he and by the way, it should be he's a better player than Nickleberry all around. It's basically neither, though, because where LaSalle's probably headed this season, neither of them are putting up numbers anywhere near gaudy enough to be on the all-conference team. But Brantley might be closer than any LaSalle guard in the last since Pookie Powell, so at least there's that.
He could. It's he's just gonna have to have massive stats because even thinking back to last year, like Clifton Moore had a really good season, and I'm pretty sure he didn't make it. I don't even know if he was discussed that
I don't
much,
think
although
he did.
but he's a great player and he's doing well now, I believe at Providence. So just it's an uphill climb, but that would be fun if Brantley made it on because he has had a nice season. And so one more all-conference question from West Pine Bills asking us, after having the most players on the preseason all-conference team, how many SLU players end up on the actual teams in March? And in the preseason, the Billikens put on four players, which I don't even know if that's ever happened before, at least since we've been keeping track of this. But right now, Yuri Collins is pretty much the only lock. He'll definitely
It's
make it.
probably two.
Yeah, who else gets on? I think you just kind of
I
pick,
think,
like.
well, I think Jimerson's headed that way. His stats got bombed out in the non-conference because he had a few really bad games at the end. But more or less, he's been one of the 15 best guys in this conference on an offensive basis. And I mean, there's still a chance for Perkins, but
I mean, I almost think
it
right
ain't
now,
gonna be
so.
four. I think it's two. I think Jimerson probably ends up there if I had to predict it.
Well, so last week when we did our own all conference teams, I actually had Pickett as my second SLU player. And I feel like he's overall had the better season for the Billikens. I think it just comes down to either if Jimerson or Perkins scores a ton of points the rest of the season, maybe they can work their way on. But I feel like between those three guys, one of them will get on. It's just hard to say which one right now. And so with that, I'd be surprised if they put three on. Unless I think the wild card is if Perkins just goes nuclear, as we
I
know he
mean,
can do.
Javon Pickett's a top three candidate for glue guy of the year right now. But I don't think St. Louis is going to be good enough for his performance to warrant the respect of all conference. Like, if you're going to score 10 points a game, you better be on clearly the best team.
Yeah, right
Or
now
else they won't put you on there.
he's at about 11 and a half and
Yeah.
6 rebounds, which is like poor man's Trey Landers numbers when he made it, and
It's
probably
kind
need to
of
go
just
up.
normal man's Trey Landers numbers, but Trey Landers did it on a top five team in the country.
I feel like Trey averaged a lot more
Trey had
rebounds, but
more rebounds, but I think the score, I think Pickett actually scoring more than Trey was.
my last comment on this, I knew he was having a quiet season for his standards, but I was not prepared to see Javonte Perkins averaging only 10 and a half
Oh,
points.
it's and that's because he had the one monster game at the end of non-con
Yeah.
that pulled it up.
I mean, I knew it wasn't great, but that was the first time in about a month where I had actually seen that number, and I wasn't prepared for that. And a lot of it too, like, I think he's averaging just under 20 minutes a game still. And he's had a lot of nights this year where he's just very limited, playing like 8, 9, 10 minutes, not doing a whole lot in the game. So we'll see. I mean, I'd love to see vintage Javonte Perkins just going off for 28 points and making every mid-range shot he can put up, but we haven't seen many of those this year.
And hey, quick shout out to Yuri Collins, who had 15 assists the other night. Although I am pissed that he scored at the end of the game to ruin what just would have
Yeah.
been a beautiful 0.15 assists, 7 rebound line.
I think he was also two steals away from getting a
He
triple
was. Yeah,
nickel
he only had
without
three
the 5
steals.
points, which would have been amazing. And that has definitely never happened. But yeah, just another fun Yuri Collins game. And speaking of fun players, we got another question from Gus of the Screen the Screener podcast, a great college basketball podcast. And he asked us if Dayton's Mike Scharf Jomps is just a slightly quicker Matthew Meyer, the former Baylor Bear now playing for Illinois, and kind of a similar player, a 6'8", 6'9" guy that handles the ball a lot and is quite versatile. So what was your take on this? I thought it was a pretty good question.
It actually kind of is. I think the best version of Mike is. Matthew Meyer was just a better shooter than Mike's shown us in the last few weeks. That's the biggest difference here.
I think long term I could see this comparison more. The problem right now is just that Sharif Jumps is not at all physical taking the ball to the rim. He's under 50% at shots at the rim this year. About 41% on 2-point attempts. And overall, if he's not making threes, he's just not any type of scoring threat. Where I feel like Meyer was able to pretty much score at all three levels. And also just the consistency factor where Mike is still just turning the ball over way too much right now. And you see those glimmers of potential out there, but as we talked about earlier on, he just hasn't had a really high impact game since the first
Yeah,
couple weeks of the season.
he needs to find a way to start attacking more. Whether it's a confidence thing or a sloppiness thing, until he gets that back, he's nowhere near his best possible self.
So I think our last question I have on the list, and I'm not sure how much it really matters this year, unfortunately, but this was from Grant, and he asked us, should the A10 try and schedule conference play in a way that maximizes bids or some other way? And so I
So,
feel like we already kind of do this, at least from the preseason, this is what happened, but certainly now it's not having a big impact.
I want to pair this with a tweet from Kev, who asks, how do we fix this league? That I think you missed on the questions list here. You can't do much. They took a better step this year going through and thinking about how they wanted to place the home and homes. But they didn't go far enough because Conference USA gave us all the answer on how to do this. Schedule games at the end of February. Like they provided this beautiful answer to everybody, and no one wants to listen. This is not an A10 problem. This is an every conference problem. And fine, if you want to make an excuse that it's too tough to schedule four games at the end of the year and you don't want to lock into the specifics of, oh, the top five have to all play each other because it's not fair. Fine. Schedule two of the home and homes at the beginning of the year. Like it was a pretty good bet that that Dayton against St. Louis was going to matter this year. And plus, it's a good rivalry game. Like just have Dayton play St. Louis and VCU. The fact that Dayton's got to play Loyola a second time when they might have a chance to get in that large bid absolutely sucks. Like, especially because everyone was wrong about Loyola from the first moment. Like, they never should have been fourth in the preseason poll. We said that from the beginning. But you look at the schedule right now at Duquesne, at George Mason, and at Richmond are Q2 games. And Dayton doesn't get a chance to play those. St. Louis doesn't get a chance to go to Fairfax or Pittsburgh. Like, the last week of the year, those games should be happening here instead of some of these bad other second games. Like Dayton's last week, they should be playing UMass at home and they should be playing either in Richmond or in Pittsburgh. Because those are two games that could actually legitimately help their resume.
I'm still not sure I'm a fan, and I actually think Conference USA went away from this model where they're not rearranging the
They
schedule for the
shouldn't
last few
have.
weeks.
Like at least do it for two games. And by the way, bring back Bracket Busters.
See,
Screw whoever killed that revival.
let me give you my problem though. Like, you hypothetically threw out, what if UMass has to go play Dayton? Well, I'll tell you right now, UMass isn't getting an at-large bid, but say they're fighting for a double bye. That's kind of unfair to load up their schedule in a way that doesn't benefit them. Like, say the Minutemen go 0-2 in the last week against Dayton and St. Louis because the A-10 says you need to lay down and give these teams a Q3 game instead of a Q4. Like,
Quite frankly, I don't care. Like
that's.
mid-majors should be stacking the deck for their best teams. That's why I love the WCC's conference tournament format, where the top two seeds get buys all the way to the semis.
See, I think that would be a better solution than changing their. I think the regular season, honestly, the way they do it is fine. Like, I think having the home and homes be protected rivalries and then trying to give some good games is an important thing. But I really don't think the A-10 could have swung it that much further in the other direction, where you had Dayton, St. Louis, VCU, Davidson all playing each other twice, and those were supposed to be four of the good teams. So without changing the schedule halfway through, I don't think there's anything better they could have done. And I think I'm fine with it. It just, this year it didn't matter because nobody had a good non-conference.
I just can't believe that Dayton's not going to play a second game in the Duquesne rivalry in lieu of a Q4 game against Loyola Chicago.
Well, I mean, that's too bad, but
That was a
Duquesne was
mistake.
also, they were supposed to be terrible, though. Like, what? And if before the season, too, like, you would have had people screaming if Dayton was playing a home and home with Duquesne.
I mean, everyone
So.
should have listened. I had Duquesne and Loyola 2 spots apart in the standings in the preseason, so.
Well, they're probably more spots than that apart now, but in the complete opposite direction. All right. Any final thoughts? It was a fun first weekend of college basketball. I will
Oh, I
say,
can't believe
or
you
of,
think we're done right now.
am I missing one?
People have been sending in questions while we've been recording here.
Oh boy.
All right. From
I'll
the
let you take over
casual
then.
observer, does a league winner who doesn't win the conference tournament get in? Yes, but Dayton or St. Louis better win 15 to 16 conference games to do so.
I'm gonna say,
It's still in play. It's not a lock, but it's very much still in play. So.
I don't think that's gonna happen though. Like, as good of a week Dayton had, I don't think they're getting to 15. That's a lot of wins.
If Malachi Smith comes back at some point in January,
January.
we can start believing that this is a multi-bid conference again. That's all I'm going to say. Or if Javonte Perkins like somehow just figures everything out in the next 3 weeks.
Yeah, if he comes back in January too, that's another one.
All right. Our guy at the Foster Lawyer Stan account asks, who is the more surprising bad 3-point shooting team, Davidson or SLU?
That's actually a great question, and both of them are kind of terrible, or at least much worse than we expected. I think St. Louis is more surprising just because with Jimmerson and Perkins, I figured they'd be so elite. And Davidson, like, Foster Lawyer was really the only guy we knew was going to be able to shoot threes, and he's still doing okay. He's just forcing it too much right now, and his efficiency has gotten killed the last couple weeks. So I think St. Louis is more surprising.
Yeah, I agree. Like, St. Louis has a lot of good shooters around the roster, and they're bottom 100 in the country, despite the fact that Jiri's shooting 44% on high volume. Or, sorry, he's shooting 44% from two. I looked at that completely wrong. He's still only, he's at his normal mid-20s from three. But the fact that Pickett's the only decent 3-point shooter on this team's a big problem. Jimmerson's got to be better than 34%. Perkins is at 33. Like, I think if we looked at this beginning of the year, talked specifics, we'd say they're both clearly above 35, and Jimmerson had a chance to be above 40.
And I think we've also seen with Sincere Parker, who came in as one of the best junior college players, pretty much the same thing as Linton Brown for St. Bonaventure last year, where he is
I just
currently
didn't think he
one
was
for
going to play
20.
that much. So,
Yeah, but he just hasn't been a 3-point threat at all, and we were thinking he would be. So, yeah, just not something that I think is. Oh, an area St. Louis can definitely improve on, though. Like, you would expect Jimmerson, especially, to go up from 34%. We know he's much more capable. So I feel like that might be a source of optimism for the Billikens, where they're hanging in there. They beat St. Joe's, even though they're still not shooting that well. And maybe by the end of the year, we see them closer to where we thought.
all right, and then our last one is from Nate Heagney, and he asks, what are some more fake trades you'd like to see between A10 teams? And I want to actually cover this more on the next episode, because if I had had an hour to think about this, I feel like I could have come up with a great answer for him, because I love this question. But we got this like 2 minutes before we started recording. So I'll fire at two quick ones. I'm going to rescind last week's trade because I didn't ever want to cause that much distress to Ryan Poleo. And also GW's like kind of decent, and I don't want to strip that roster. So I have a similar one though. Tom Welch to St. Louis for Jake Forrester and a national TV game. Like St. Louis, once again, they just need just a tough guy down there to just scrap for rebounds and shoot at a high percentage. That's exactly what Tom Welch does. Lyle is not going anywhere this year. They're a middle of the pack team at best. Welch would, I think having Welch on the St. Louis team could actually swing a game or two for them.
Well, I am going to make Ryan upset because I do have a GW trade. And mine is going to be we're going to send Maximus Edwards over to VCU, who we haven't even talked about VCU, by the way. But GW really needs some help with their post defense. It's just a nightmare. So we're going to give them Jalen Deloach. I think VCU can get by. They have
I think
enough
that
good
kind of
defenders,
kills
so.
VCU, honestly,
But their offense
because
is
they
so
do
bad.
not trust any of their backup centers right now.
They're gonna have to make it work though, because they can't score. And I think Edwards can create enough where he'll give Ace enough support and it balances out the team a little bit better. I do agree, like it might completely backfire, but I'm just trusting that the rest of ECU, like the rest of their defenders, can step up and
I'd
make up
actually
for it.
almost expand that trade that VCU throws in another wing and gets back Hunter Dean.
I mean, that's fine. I guess. I guess he'll play.
All right, my last one here for today, a big blockbuster. This is going to be expensive for the UMass fans, and I'm sorry that they'll have to go through this, but Eric Reynolds to UMass for RJ Lewis and a future recruit. This is basically a tank
Oh.
move for St. Joe's. If they just decide that they're done with Lang at the end of this year, it would actually help them to be even worse, to really be able to sell home to their fans. But they get a good young all-around guy in RJ Lewis, who's going to be a good player in this league eventually, but has a lot of places to grow in. Eric Reynolds with a year of Frank Martin. Holy hell, could that be great? He needs a coach that's just going to kick his ass because he is a special scorer right now and is exactly what this UMass team needs. But what's best for him is a guy who's going to ride him to get better at every other facet of the game, to really work hard. He could be a good defender. He has the athleticism for it. He's a decent passer who, on this bad team, has no incentive to pass. But you put him as UMass's sixth man to give them some scoring pop coming off the bench. Like, we're not going to see the second half that they had against North Texas ever again.
I want to
And
talk about the other part of this. We're trading a recruit now. Has NIL gone too far?
yeah, well, you got to give them some sort of future consideration here. Like, you can't even kick in like a broadcast improvement because, as great as the Burnham Sullivan pairing is over at UMass, like, does it help St. Joe's to switch out Martucci for Jay Burnham? Not really. We're talking about two of the elite guys in the A-10 here.
Yeah, we can't kill either of the two best ESPN Plus broadcasts,
I
so.
guess maybe, like, can we have Nesson step in on the St. Joe's broadcast because the outer level things outside of the announcers are just a lot better on UMass than really most of the teams in the A-10.
Yeah, they've done a good job. Shout out to Davidson, by the way, too, for their ESPN Plus. They have commercials this year. And
Well,
wasn't sure about that.
they started it in the San Francisco game, and there was an issue. I was watching it on my laptop, and every time it would come back from commercial, the feed would cut. And I would have to go restart it. And they
Oh,
finally fixed that.
we're making progress.
Shout out to Dayton, too. They got rid of those horrible announcers.
Oh, is it?
I like the duo they had on the last game.
All right, here we
What was her name?
go.
Shout out, I think her name was Christine Sabo, who was an actual like ex-UD women's player. So much better than the color commentator who literally couldn't figure out how to pronounce anyone's names last season.
There we
He gave
go.
us insights. He just gave us reasons to make fun of the fact that he was paid to announce a basketball game.
And with conference play too here, though, we are going to get some more national TV games, which is great. Not quite. I mean, there's still a lot of ESPN Plus the next couple weeks, especially as football's wrapping up. But later on, we'll have a lot more CBS USA games, which is always a joy. We're also getting close. I think next week with Dayton and VCU, it's our first Friday 10 game, which is always a blast.
Yeah, that's going to be great. And I am pretty sure we got Mike Corey again on that, the voice of Friday Night A10, who is in the upper echelon of national guys for the conference. But I want to close it on this. The CAA had a game on CBSSN the other day that was called by John Fanta and Dr. John Giannini. And my immediate reaction was the CAA is lesser than the A10 in the TV hierarchy. How the hell did they get that pairing? Like, that should be every Tuesday night for the A10. That is ridiculous. Unless you're going to put Tom McCarthy out there, who is very good. Any other pair duo that CBSSN is going to trot out for the A10 is a full notch to two notches worse than Fanta and Dr. John.
I
That
hope we
would
get
be
Dr. John soon.
fantastic.
I
By
mean,
the way, like Fanta's really good too. That would be a great pairing for the A10. I'm so pissed that the CAA got this.
well,
What the hell?
I would complain, but the CAA does have a team that would win the A10, so I can't be upset this year, I think. And good for them getting some good
Good. And I
broadcasters.
hope Fanta and Dr. John get as many College of Charleston games as possible
And it's still, it
because that.
doesn't.
Because those two deserve to call games for that team because they are freaking good.
And
I
also,
can't
I
believe it
mean,
took this long for them to get ranked.
the CAA fans deserve a break. I mean, they're used to flow hoops. So for the like 5% of their national games, we might as well give them one of the best pairings.
Yeah, and if there's anyone from the conference who's possibly listening to this, we will say this for the fifth straight year. Please give us more Dr. John on these games. And if you want to throw in John Fanta, that would be wonderful as well. Or give us Dr. John with Tom McCarthy. That would be a good pairing too.
Sounds great.
Can we switch him to ESPN and give him Mike Corey? I'd also like that. Or just put Martucci on national TV. Like all of these would work.
Right. Well, as normal, the mailbag dragged on longer than normal. But any other final thoughts as we head into another week of conference play, the first full week with 7 games on Wednesday and Saturday?
Yeah, we have a quadruple header on Saturday. That's my only closing thought here. That is going to be fantastic. We have standalone games at noon, 4, and 6, and then weirdly 4 games at the same time at 2 o'clock. So everyone get ready, get your snacks prepared. This is the beginning of our training for the conference tournament as fans and watchers of this conference. All closing out with Duquesne Richmond, which is a really good and possibly really important game in the double bye race. So I hope everyone's still standing come, or I guess still sitting, come hours 7 and 8, because that's a great cherry on top of this Sunday of a Saturday. So, and by the way, Davidson VCU to kick it off, which is pretty fun as well.
Yeah, it's going to be a great weekend, and
It's going to be a
at least
wonderful
this
Saturday, but
time.
we don't get the Ron Holmes. That's the only bad thing because they're the
I
bye
know, but
team.
I'm almost okay with that though, because I'm always plugged into the Dayton games, and this will give me a chance to see what's going on around the rest of the league. And we do have a few standalone games, which is perfect too. So, no, it'll be fun. And then Wednesday night as well, we've got a couple of good games coming up too. So overall, just it's great that conference plays back in full swing.
Yep, and by the way, for anyone curious, the other standalone is Bonaventure in St. Louis at 4 o'clock out east, 3 o'clock in St. Louis time. Everyone else is stuck in that 2 o'clock window. But this is the last week without the spread out. Next week we get Tuesday and Friday back, so we have that to look forward to. But a thank you to everyone who sent in mailbag questions. We appreciate them as always. Some very good ones. Apologies to Nate. We will answer that question in full on next week's episode. Promise that. Thank you to everyone for listening and sticking around as we open the mailbag. Thank you to conference play and the college basketball gods for bringing it back to us. It's just so much better when you know so much about both of the teams. It makes the game so much more enjoyable to watch. And yeah, everybody enjoy the quadruple header. It's going to be a lot of fun. Try to keep yourselves awake, going, and still excited for all 8 of those hours.